Are we on?
Yes.
This is TLQ Live. I'm not sure what the deal is here. I'm not very experienced at this. Usually James Edwards is the MC for this, and he's very experienced, very professional. It is my first time as a host. But tonight, very privileged to have Brenton Sanderson, who has been a very prolific contributor to Axon Quarterly over the years, going back, I think, to 2012, at least. And
2011.
yeah, he's in Australia, so which is why we have the show on Saturday night. I guess I should just say Brenton is someone who's a former academic. He used to teach in colleges and so on, but he's given all that up and working, making money. He's a father of a young 1.5-year-old son. And I guess you are writing a book on white Australia policy, right?
Thanks for inviting me to participate today, Kevin. I'm putting together, so hopefully listeners will be familiar with my series on white Australia called The War on White Australia. Hoping to eventually publish that as a volume. Of course, it's going to be pretty difficult with all the banning and censorship going on at the moment. But I'll still push ahead with it, and hopefully we'll get that published pretty soon.
As is obvious, we're not going to see Brenton's face tonight. Instead, we see a kangaroo, which is quite appropriate. But it's all because of this enormous pressure that's being exerted on dissident intellectuals throughout the West. I mean, books have been banned. Now, recently, Amazon has banned books from Jared Taylor. My book, The Culture of Critique, has been banned. It's the only academically published book that has been banned. Sites like Occidental Quarterly have been deplatformed. The credit card companies have withdrawn services. PayPal, MasterCard, all those companies have withdrawn their services. So it's very hard to get recurrent subscriptions and so on. We have to rely on, people sending checks in the old-fashioned ways, and people aren't used to doing that anymore. So easy to do this with a credit card. You set up a recurrent donation or something. So we are really going through some difficult times, and it's very important to subscribe to the Axon Quarterly. We have top-rate articles on all the issues really related to the West, Western survival, the activists who are opposing us, and our own points of view on various things like immigration policy and cultural issues. So we are under the gun these days, and it's very important for people, thinking about where to spend a little money and make a contribution, to try to keep these intellectual journals alive by supporting them. The goal is to be self-sufficient. We have cut down expenses. We're not using our former printer, which was rather expensive. Postage costs have been lowered dramatically. So we're doing all we can, but we really need subscriptions. And again, this is a top-rate journal, and we are very happy, very privileged to have with us tonight Brenton Sanderson, who's contributed great articles to Axon Observer consistently. And we could talk about a lot of different things in that regard, but let's start with your articles. I think it was 2012 on the White Australia policy. Fascinating subject. And
It is a fascinating subject.
you mentioned at the beginning that Australians had this image of themselves as having a kinship connection with Britain, a strong kinship connection. And of course, if you have such an idea, you don't just willy-nilly let in everybody else in the world to come into your country.
Absolutely. So Australian identity, basically, it consisted of sort of three overlapping categories. So there was racial whiteness, there was Australianness, and Britishness. So sort of three overlapping categories. From the beginning, if any of you know any history of Australia when British settlement of Australia began in 1788. So Australia started as a penal colony, basically a dumping ground for convicts. And that continued right through to 1853. So the population built up slowly over that period. In the 1850s, we actually had the gold rush, and that actually attracted a lot of non-whites to come to Australia, so particularly the Chinese. And there was actually a lot of ethnic tension on the gold fields. There was riots and so on. And the colonial authorities actually banned Chinese arrivals from that point. They didn't deport those who were already here. They kept them here. They basically wanted Australian identity was very much bound up with the notion of being white. Obviously, the majority of the population were British descendants, either of the English or of Scottish, Welsh, some Irish as well. And they wanted to keep it that way. And when the British colonies federated in 1901, the first Act of Parliament that they passed of the new nation was the Immigration Restriction Act, which basically gave the government the right to exclude. What they did was they had a dictation test in any European language. So any migrant intending to come to Australia could be given this test. And it was basically designed to exclude non-whites from coming to Australia. It was also an industrial relations policy. A lot of people forget that. We could describe it as a group evolutionary strategy and a fairly explicit one of wanting to preserve a particular stock of people, guarantee their genetic line into the future, guarantee their control of the culture and of the country. But it was also designed to maintain high wages, high living standards in the country. And, right. Not have, individual business people, bring in cheap labor from, obviously there's plentiful labor in it to the north of Australia. We have Indonesia, Pacific Islanders and so on. And business people did try to do that. They did try to bring in cheap labor. You had, sugarcane growers in Queensland tried to bring in Islander labor. But at the time, the idea was that we want to maintain a cohesive white society. We want it to have high living standards, high wages. And this was basically a cross-party agreement on this, for the next 70 years until the White Australia policy was dismantled in the 1970s.
Right. Of course, we have that same problem now, and I'm sure Australia does too, with capitalists wanting to import cheap labor. I mean, it is a really big problem. And far too many in the Republican Party in the United States, the support comes from capitalists who want cheap labor. And so
it's a real problem.
So that's ethnic identity. They don't care about cohesiveness. All they want is profits. It's a problem for a capitalist individualist society like the West to have those kind of policies that protect them. But yeah, Australia very explicitly, and those are the sort of good old days when people just really talked about race. White Australia in the 1920s, yep. It was common, and then the demise really around the time when it happened in America, the UK, and elsewhere in the West. You had a complete collapse of this system. And it was a top-down change, wasn't it, in Australia, as it was throughout the West. It was always that people...
It really was, yeah.
...that promoted this.
Absolutely. You can't get much more top-down than international law. And it really started in the 1950s. Of course, you had... In your book, The Culture of Critique, you've gone into detail about the Boasian School of Anthropology.
Right.
And I think you talk about Ashley Montagu. Ashley Montagu was born Israel Ehrenberg. He was the one who basically drafted the UNESCO Statement on Race in 1951.
Yeah.
Basically, a group of anthropologists got together and, came up with the UN's opinion on race. And, of course, they concluded race is not a biological phenomenon. Incorrect. It's a social myth. Incorrect. Basically saying that genetic similarities, far outweigh differences, and that race is not an important social category. And that statement was cited in the Brown versus Board of Education case in 1954. And it's actually that declaration has been called the triumph of Boasian Boasian anthropology on a world historical scale.
Right.
It's so significant. And that was later translated into the UN Declaration on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, which came about in 1963. So, yeah, basically, again, we've got one individual who's influential, who knows the right people, influencing international law. And then, of course, once there's an international declaration, there's pressure on every government to, you know, adopt it, and you take it from there.
Right. And it shows, again, how important the academic world is. I mean, a lot of people think of professors as ivory tower people. Well, a lot of them are and have been activists. And Franz Boas was the paradigm of that. I mean, you know, he established his Department of Anthropology at Columbia. All his students then came out of Columbia, and because of his prestige, he was able to place them in all these other top departments, and pretty soon, the entire academic establishment, the Executive Board of the American Anthropological Association, is taken over by these people. And because the academic world is basically international, that's going to definitely filter down to everywhere in the academic world in the West, including Australia, I imagine.
It absolutely did, yeah. So in the 50s and 60s, Australian universities became sort of hotbeds of resistance against the White Australia policy. White Australia policy was very popular in the community. There was no popular movement to get rid of it. Basically, you had academics in Australian universities who, you know, wrote books about it. I know a group of academics at Melbourne University, they formed a group called the Immigration Reform Group in 1963. Interestingly, a prominent Jewish leader, Peter Wertheim, was a member of that group. So even back in 1963, they were putting pressure on the Australian government to abandon, restrictive immigration policies and so on. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. It comes down from on high. And the Ivy League universities back then and still today really set the agenda for the rest of the world.
They set the tone. And if you're a professor at Harvard or someplace like that, Princeton, Yale, you then place your students at the University of Wisconsin or at Berkeley. You know, so the second level then, gets these students. And then the professors at Wisconsin, they send their students off to the University of Wisconsin at Oshkosh or someplace like that. So it's a top-down kind of system. And in the course of your work, you've mentioned several very influential academics and activists on the White Australia policy. Well, I guess an activist would be this guy Walter Lippmann. I hadn't heard of him until your work. Very interesting.
Yeah, Walter Lippmann, if you look up Walter Lippmann on the internet, the first name will come up. There was a journalist in America of that name around in the early 20th century. So, well, we're not talking about that guy, so it's a different guy. So he was a leader of the Jewish community in Australia. He was a migrant from Germany, German-Jewish migrant. When he arrived in Australia, he talked about resenting the notions of Anglo-cultural superiority that he confronted, the expectation to assimilate. He found that quite offensive. Mm-hmm. And he really believed Australia should change to fit the migrant rather than the migrant having to change to fit into the local culture.
Yeah.
His activism really began in terms of promoting multiculturalism, refugees, and so on. The 1971 census figures came out showing a decline in the number of Jews in Australia, number of people identifying as Jewish. So that to him was shocking. He identified three main causes of that. The fact that a lot of migrants who came to Australia following World War II were middle-aged. They had a relatively low birth rate. And if you look at the history of Jewry in Australia, particularly pre-World War II, what we call Anglo-Jewry, they actually were quite highly assimilated into the Anglo-Australian culture. So you had intermarriage rates of up to, 25%.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the prominent Jewish activists were worried about that. So the idea of sort of promoting multiculturalism was very much to forge a stronger Jewish identity, independent of the dominant Anglo-Australian identity, and to ensure and to lower, basically lower intermarriage, and, you know, get a government. Once you've got the government supporting individual ethnic groups, funding them, and so on, he saw that as like a safeguard for the Jewish community in Australia going forward. That right. they would maintain themselves as a distinct group.
Yes, and we see the same thing in America. Of course, Horace Kallen is a philosopher, is credited with sort of starting this multicultural ideal that America should be considered a sort of symphony of cooperating, harmoniously cooperating groups, and Jews wouldn't have to really assimilate. They'd be able to keep their identity, and that has been a bedrock aspect of Jewish thinking that really permeates the entire organized Jewish community. I mean, they are all into that. And so the immigrants coming into this country now are not encouraged to assimilate. They are, encouraged to retain their culture, retain their identity. Really, there is no such thing as an American identity that has anything to do with the founding population. It's all just a proposition, the proposition nation idea, we're all just human rights and democracy. That's all it's about, that's just a pervasive idea within the Jewish community.
And even beyond that, it's not just a matter of promoting the cultures of the migrants arriving. It's actually denigrating the mainstream culture.
Yeah, that's true.
Making it unlovable. Why would you identify with this culture? It's so, it's evil, it's racist, and so on. Right. So it's a two-pronged strategy.
In your work, one of the people that the Jewish intellectuals that you mentioned that has been really instrumental in this cultural criticism has been Colin Tatz and his idea that, white Australian genocide of the Aboriginals and hanging a sort of genocide label on traditional Australia, right?
Yeah. So that was, I think, late last year in the Occidental Quarterly. So, Colin Tatz and the genocide charge. Yeah, so very interesting case. So what we have is he was originally from South Africa, lived under apartheid in South Africa. He was very much, opposed to apartheid. Having said that, he was, like, in terms of wanting to leave South Africa, his first choice was to go to Israel, which Israel actually does have a policy of effectively a policy of apartheid. So it wasn't so much, a moral opposition to the idea of a distinct people controlling a particular area. It was just the fact that white people actually decided on doing that in South Africa. So that article, basically what it is about is that it talks about Australia Day and how Australia Day is 26th of January is the day in 1788 that the first permanent European migrants arrived in Australia, settlers arrived in Australia, and how that day has, over the last 10 years, it's been reframed as Invasion Day. And, as the birth of the, the white genocide of the Aboriginal people, and that type of thing. So I was interested in, where does this notion come from? And sure enough, I traced it back to a sort of a cabal of Jewish intellectuals. Tony Barter from La Trobe University was the first to, assert that, the Aboriginal people had, suffered a genocide. That was in 1984. Colin Tatz sort of followed on from him. And he's really pushed this notion of Australia as a nation built on genocide, stresses the idea of the stolen generations, this notion that, part Aboriginal children were taken from their parents, as part of a genocidal policy to breed out the Aboriginal race. There's no factual basis for that assertion. I can go into that in more detail if you like. He's basically created an infrastructure for pushing this idea. He's created, genocide studies, institutes at prominent Australian universities. He's created a journal called Genocide's Perspectives. The thing that he does is equate. So he's come up with this controversial thesis, which is becoming more and more mainstream. If you question it, he will call you a denier. So the clear implication is they're wanting to equate denial of the notion that white Australians, you know, committed genocide against the Aborigines with Holocaust denial.
Yeah.
And it's basically about it's psychological manipulation.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, what you mentioned is, you know, these ideas start at these universities, and actually related to this, you know, Discovery Day or wherever it is. I remember when I was in Melbourne, there was a statue of one of the it was a Cook, I think Captain Cook, right? Which was defaced.
Yeah.
And it was covered up, so you really couldn't see the statue anymore. They were undergoing repairs or something. I don't know what they're doing, but yeah, they
actually. Yeah. Basically, you've had defacing of monuments to European explorers, Captain Cook, Lachlan Macquarie, one of the first governors of the colony of New South Wales. So, as the symbols of white, not only is white Australia under attack demographically, but the symbols of white Australia, the history of white Australia is also under attack. Mm-hmm. And, and a lot of that defacing of monuments, of statues, actually that kind of began around the time that, Confederate monuments in the US were being defaced and taken down. So, again, an example of events in America having a cascading effect throughout the West. Once Australian activists saw what they were doing in the U.S., they thought, okay, let's do that here.
Yeah, we've seen so much of it here. You know, it started out with Confederate monuments, but it's extending to founding fathers. I mean, Thomas Jefferson and Washington, people like that, because they own slaves. They're gradually removing our entire history or vilifying our entire history. So that is part of the whole process. And again, you know, and this goes back all the way to the whole thing on immigration, that when these movements really gain traction, then all the book publishers, the mass media get on board. If you're an academic and you want to, you know, make your reputation, you get a book contract to something related positive about immigration in some way. And that's really the way the culture changes. I mean, that's what's happened really throughout the West, I think, that publishers, the media, and that's why we're seeing the shutting down of alternative viewpoints, right? The left is used to... Back in the 1950s, believed in free speech because there are all these communists being hauled up before McCarthy's committees and other the House Un-American Activities Committee in this country, because there's huge anti-communist fervor in the 1950s. But nowadays, obviously, free speech is not a value of the left, and certainly not of the Jewish community. I know the Jewish community has made alliances with these immigrant groups, right? And they have promoted these hate speech laws in Australia, isn't that right?
Oh, that's correct. Yeah. Even groups that you would think, well, you know, Jews would not have, you know, the same interests like Muslims. From the earliest days of multiculturalism in Australia, Jews have attempted to form alliances with Muslims and other groups especially promote these hate speech laws. In Australia, we have, under the Racial Discrimination Act, Section 18C, which is quite notorious, actually makes it illegal to offend someone on the basis of race.
Right.
So not just commit, you know, an offense, you know, assault or whatever, harass, but it's actually even just to offend.
Mm.
So it's a very low standard.
So it's from the point of view of the person who says he's offended, is that it?
Yeah, it's completely subjective.
Right. Famously, there was a case of Andrew Bolt, I think, and also Andrew Fraser, Professor Fraser, was a law professor at, Macquarie University or one of the universities?
Macquarie, yeah.
Yeah, Macquarie. He just simply cited the statistics on black criminality, that it wasn't a good idea to bring these people in, and I'm sure the statistics continue to bear him out. I've read about riots in Melbourne by these African immigrants.
Yeah, that's been a disaster. It really has.
Yeah, he was nailed, right? I mean,
he had to publish an apology. I think he lost his job, his academic job.
Yeah, he lost his
academic. There's been quite a few cases. Andrew Bold actually wrote an article in the mainstream media, basically talking about how people with tiny amounts of Aboriginal ancestry or none at all were taking advantage of the whole sort of, money being thrown at Aboriginal affairs. And, you've got scholarships and affirmative action, taking advantage of that for their own, personal advancement. So some of the people he talked about took him to court, saying they were offended by what he said. And, he won he lost that case. So they won. And, of course, there was a Jewish judge. And they were represented by Jewish lawyers free of charge. So
I remember
pushing this law. I mean, there was actually a movement a couple of years ago to actually amend the Racial Discrimination Act to get water down these laws. And if you remember Prime Minister Tony Abbott, who's no longer Prime Minister, but at the time he went to the 2013 election promising to get rid of these laws or to amend them. And there was basically the Jewish community piled on, Jewish activists, and he just backed down, and we still have them. So that even the Prime Minister, you've got an election promise. He said he would do it. People voted for him. He had a mandate. But even that is not enough to have these laws watered down when you have the Jewish activist community at your neck.
Well, it just goes to show that countries in the West, certainly the United States and Australia, from what you're saying, they're sort of oligarchies. They're not true democracies because you have a mandate there. This guy gets elected, Abbott gets elected on that platform, but he can't implement the policy. And if you look at
with Donald Trump, really,
right? The same with Donald Trump. He can't implement his policies because there's so much opposition, and the courts keep ruling against him, and delays, and this, that, and the other thing, and the investigation, which thankfully is over, from Bob Mueller and all that. But there was a paper by these Princeton University political scientists noting that politics in the United States is not really democratic. That when there are issues where these oligarchs are, really wealthy people that donate, where they have different views than the rest of the population, the oligarchs prevail. One good example, of course, is the Israel lobby, which is completely controlled by, Jewish activists. They talk about Christian evangelicals in the United States, but they have zero influence on actual policy. The real money and everything comes from these Jewish activists, and they control United States foreign policy. I'm sure there's a similar situation in Australia. I mean, Jewish wealth and their willingness to contribute to these political causes like Zionism and multiculturalism is a huge factor in all this.
It's exactly the same here. So we have, the Jewish population of Australia is 0.4% of the total population. So around 120,000 out of a population of 25 million. So recent figures came out. So out of the top 10 wealthiest individuals in Australia, so half of them are Jewish. So 5 out of 10, the wealthiest, individual in Australia. So Anthony Pratt is a businessman. So he's Jewish. He donates large sums to both sides of politics, as do with John Gandel, another Jewish property developer. He donates large sums to both sides of politics. He's a rabid Zionist, so he funds Birthright Israel in Australia, which gives free trips to young Jewish, teenagers, young people to reaffirm their Jewish identity. So he promotes that. At the same time, he also funds the Anti-Defamation Commission in Australia, runs a program called Click Against Hate, which is meant to be a cyber safety program for schools. And of course, basically the message is anti-white and pro-immigration, pro-multiculturalism. So on the one hand, you've got, wealthy individuals like Gandel funding multicultural propaganda in our schools. And on the other hand, he's funding Birthright Israel and, you know, other Jewish activist groups, and making large donations to both sides of politics as well. So to ensure they don't stray off the reservation.
Right. Yeah. Making contributions to both sides, very important, especially for Israel policy, because they want the policy to be bipartisan, and it's sort of falling apart. I don't know if that's happening in Australia, but in the United States, the real progressive left is really souring on Israel. But again, it's hard to see how the Democratic Party is going to go along with that, because the money comes from Jews. I mean, really, the great majority of the political donation of the Democratic Party are Jewish, and significant, maybe 40% to the Republican Party. But, you know, it's huge. And these people call the shots. And they tend to be older Jews. They tend to be much more committed to Israel as the, sort of their first priority. People like Chaim Sabin. And Soros also, who's not really an ardent Zionist, but he sure is an ardent multiculturalist. But we certainly have that phenomenon in the United States. And Birthright Israel, I'm glad you mentioned that. I mean, this is the paradigm of a sort of ethnocentric program. It also exists in America and Canada and probably elsewhere. They take these kids to Auschwitz and then they take them to Israel. And the whole pitch is, you know, Israel is always threatened by these enemies. But not only that, you must marry someone who's Jewish. You know, the whole idea of endogamy is as old as Judaism. And they are pushing that because, you know, there is a lot of intermarriage going on. But they are still, you know, very important programs that combat this. And of course, these are sponsored by wealthy Jews, as in Australia. The Bronfman family is the big donor that I'm aware of, but I'm sure there are others. Yes, you have the same kind of mentality where you support Jewish ethnocentrism, Jews marrying other Jews, but you also support multicultural programs in the diaspora. You promote massive immigration of other groups. You make alliances with these other groups and fund those sorts of things as well. So, I mean, that's really, you know, as I've said many times, you know, Jews don't tend to have a sort of principled morality. It's really what comes down to the cliche, what's good for the Jews. And what's good for the Jews in the United States or in Australia is not the same as what's good for Jews in Israel. You know, they have very different policies in that regard.
They do, yeah. No, they're completely hypocritical. But you know, when you charge them with hypocrisy, it's just water off a duck's back. They don't care.
Yeah.
It's you know, they're going to push their agenda. They know what's good for them in the diaspora versus what's good for them in Israel, and they'll just basically promote what they see as, you know, in their best interests, and nothing will dissuade them from sticking with it. You know, charges of hypocrisy, they don't care.
Yeah, it's like water off a duck's back, as we say. It doesn't affect them. I mean, we have an Axel Observer. I think I got like 75, 90 articles, or, you know, a huge number of articles on a category of Jewish double standards on immigration and multiculturalism. I mean, it's pervasive. Jewish organizations very critical of the United States building a wall down the southern border in Mexico. But, yeah, they're entirely on board. They never criticize Israel for having their wall that keeps out Africans.
Or not taking any Syrian refugees.
What's that?
Or not taking any Syrian refugees.
Not taking Syrian refugees. And you actually have Israeli NGOs going to Greece and other areas where the Syrian refugees are coming and promoting their immigration to Europe. Not different. Yeah, so it's like...
Infuriating.
It's infuriating, absolutely infuriating. Yeah. But, you know, it's still a taboo to talk about these issues in America. When, you know, now you've got this Muslim congresswoman, her name was Omar from Minnesota, and she talked about why does the United States support Israel? She says it's all about the Benjamins. It's all about the money. Boy, did they come down on her. And then she implied that Jews were disloyal. which, you know, is a third rail where they just really go nuts. They don't want to argue with you any details. So they don't want to talk about how much money is in the Israel lobby and how it all works. But they do want to call you an anti-Semite, and that certainly would happen to her. I imagine you'd see the same thing in Israel, where if you mention these things, you will be pilloried in the mainstream media and probably brought up on hate crime charges. We don't have that yet here, but, you know, close.
Yeah, we actually had, I think it was 4 years ago, so you had the former foreign minister, Bob Carr, actually, he's quite supportive of the Palestinians, a bit like the situation of what you were talking about with the left. There's pressure within the left to move away from being pro-Zionist. I guess probably the best example to talk about now would be the UK with Jeremy Corbyn and the defection of Jewish MPs from Labour. But yeah, a few years ago, he basically said that. So in Australia, we have an organisation called the Australia Israel Jewish Affairs Council, and led by a guy called Colin Rubenstein. And that is kind of that's basically the equivalent of AIPAC in the US. Basically, it's a Zionist lobby group. And so Bob Carr came out. He wrote a book a few years ago, and in that book, he briefly mentioned the fact that they lobbied him very, very aggressively, and he started to resent it. And of course, once that became public and he was interviewed, and, you know, he didn't back down on what he was saying. You know, basically, they were constant, anything about Israel, he would just get total, you know, get a barrage of messages from that lobby. And, there was, you know, the Jewish, activists in Australia went crazy over that, even just mentioning the fact that, you know, that they lobby so aggressively. Similar situation here.
Similar situation. Well, actually, this for some reason reminds me of this Fraser Anning, who's a political figure now in Australia. And what do you think of Fraser Anning? I mean, he's quite nationalist, quite opposed to immigration, very critical of Muslims and so on.
Yeah, Fraser Anning. So, yeah, of course. He sort of came into prominence recently with, obviously, we had the event in Christchurch, the shooting in Christchurch. And so there's been a media frenzy since then about, you know, anyone who is not 100% in favor of multiculturalism and diversity and so on. So he made some comments, after that event, basically saying, you know, that if it wasn't for this, you know, large-scale Muslim immigration to countries like Australia and New Zealand, we wouldn't be in this situation. We wouldn't have these tensions. And of course, you know, the mainstream media attacked him, vilified him, you know, you're a fascist and so on. You might have seen a guy actually cracked an egg on his head and he slapped him back.
Oh, yeah.
You might have seen that. Possibly, yeah.
Can he belt?
He's actually really good. But even with him, the interesting thing with Fraser Anning, he claims to be pro-Israel. So even with someone, he stands up. He believes in the white Australia policy. He believes in, you know, immigration restriction. He's anti-Muslim, obviously. But even then, even as you know, far away from the mainstream as he is, he still tries to court the Jewish community in Australia. So there's still that, you know, that step you're not willing to take, beyond, you know, the ultimate step beyond the realms of acceptability within our society. He's not willing to take that step. It might be strategic. It probably is strategic, but interesting anyway.
Well, I'll take a wild guess that the Jewish community is not welcoming him with open arms, despite his support for Israel.
Absolutely not.
No. They're just not going to support that. I've been very impressed. I follow him on Twitter, and he says some amazing things. But there's limitations to you know, he's not an intellectual, I imagine. But it's great to see someone like that. I mean, if he had power, he'd probably be like a Salvini in Italy or something like that.
So recently this week, so there's been a lot of discussion about within politics about preferencing. So in Australia, we have a preferential voting system. So you list for the lower house, the House of Representatives, you list the parties you favour in order of preference. So you number them from 1, 2, 3 down to the bottom. And the Labour Party has pledged to place Well, Fraser Anning and One Nation. He used to be a part of One Nation, but then he left. So they're promising to put One Nation last, and they're asking for the Liberal Party, the other major party in Australia, to also put One Nation last. And so the Prime Minister Scott Morrison has said that they will do that, although the sort of the party organisation's not really happy with it because it could lead to them losing a few seats, a few contests around Australia. So that's been the big debate at the moment about you know, One Nation is unacceptable. We need to put them last, get rid of them from the political scene altogether.
Yeah. His comment after the Christchurch shooting was basically that, you know, you're not going to have this if you have Muslims in the country. And predictably, the media went wild. We had an article on Axel Observer by Tobias Langdings, one of our regular writers. And, you know, they were going after Hungary for their policies and so on. And Langdings points out, one thing about Hungary, there haven't been any of these Muslim shootings there because they have prevented this. You know, I mean, it's sort of obvious. Yeah. And yet it's one of those things that you cannot say. There's so many things now that you can't say without being in danger of losing your job in this country and going to prison or paying a fine in Australia. It's
insane. So we have a society now. So, you know, we're constantly told, you know, diversity is our strength. Multiculturalism is wonderful. And yet at the whole, like if we take Australia or the US or Britain, really it's, if it wasn't for the surveillance state, if it wasn't for the police state and monitoring and so on, we would have. So as terrible as Christchurch was, and, you know, I denounce violence and criminal behavior. You know, our struggle is it's a political and ideological struggle to win the hearts and minds of white people. We want to encourage them to take their own side and support policies in their own interests. We're not in favor of, you know, terrorism or anything like that. Well, what was I saying? I've lost my train of thought.
Oh, we're certainly, you know, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to convince white people to take our own.
Oh, yeah. So what I was saying was, so if it wasn't for, if we didn't have police surveillance of, you know, Islamists and radicals and so on, if you took that away for 24 hours, we would have violence on a huge scale throughout the West. There would be terrorist attacks. There would be massacres. So we've, and this society that we have, that where we have basically massacres and, you know, bombings and so on, they're only suppressed by the surveillance state and the police.
Right.
So this situation has been engineered. This is not natural. This has been engineered deliberately. Now those who engineered it back, if we're talking about the Jewish community in the 70s promoting multiculturalism and diversity. I mean, I'm sure probably they didn't want this violence, but anyone with any knowledge of Islam and of Islamic societies would know that if you are importing this group, you are also importing this radical ideology and potentially violence. And yet they were willing to go ahead with it anyway.
Yeah.
We're in a completely, this multicultural system we have is probably the most radical social experiment in history.
It is.
And yet we are called the extremists for opposing it.
Right. And one, you know, one of the things that you've noticed, everybody has noticed, is that there has been a rise in the surveillance state. I mean, we didn't have this when I was a kid. You know, I mean, it's not just the technology, but the intention. I know in the UK, there are thousands of these Muslims that are tracked, you know, it's a huge job of police. Same in France. I'm sure it's the same in America and in Australia.
Germany, everywhere.
Yeah. And so, you know, and there are cameras in every street corner. And, you know, there's just amazing. You know, we're setting up the sort of infrastructure for a police state. And I am very worried that if the wrong people get in, you see the left now. Extremely intolerant. They don't believe in free speech. You see the Antifa, they're willing to crack heads, you know, commit violence against people who take different points of view. We're going to see that more and more in the future, I think.
Yeah, it's intensifying.
Yeah, and one other thing, Andrew Joyce had a couple of articles, at least one article, in Europe. These Jewish organizations have prevailed on the government to get all these funds to protect Jewish institutions. So on the one hand, the Jewish institutions are promoting, organizations are promoting this mass immigration, but they're also promoting the idea that they get sort of special treatment, special protection. And so you have, police that are stationed outside synagogues and schools, and you have in London, you have something called the Community Security Trust or something like that, where they go around in cars and really police, like a quasi police force, and it's all directed at protecting Jews. So this is where we're at now. We're entering the stage of really the West is a police state, and that's the way it's going to be.
It's the same in Australia.
Pardon?
So it's the same in Australia. We have the Jewish community gets federal government funding for security for their schools. So if you Jewish schools in Australia, if you go past them, there's barbed wire all around them. There's guards with machine guns standing out the front. And this is all funded by Australian taxpayers. We didn't ask for this situation. We don't want a society that's so volatile that, you need to have guards with machine guns at the front of schools. But it's what we have now. We didn't ask for it, but it's been imposed on us against the will of the majority.
Right. In America, after 9/11, after the 9/11 attacks, they developed these programs where groups could request funding for greater security. Well, almost all that money has gone to Jewish organizations in America. So that's just typical. And, it used to be with you'd have celebrations like New Year's Eve, and you'd just sort of enjoy yourself. Now you've got a whole thousands of police. You got cameras. You got, helicopters and, everybody, the surveillance. Because they know that any big crowd is now an opportunity target for these terrorists. And so it's a cost, yet another cost of this massive multicultural immigration that we're undergoing.
Yeah, and in Australia, the government's just announced that they're, putting, I think it's $550 million more into terrorist surveillance and so on. It's just ramping up year after year after year. Who knows where it's going to end?
Yeah, who knows? Well, I think where it's leading is a police state, and I do think if present trends continue. I mean, in America, what the left has done is simply import a new people which will reliably vote for them. I mean, the vast majority of American immigrants are poor, uneducated. They vote for the left. They want free stuff. They vote for parties that are pro-immigration. I believe that's the case in the UK, where these immigrants, Muslims, tend to vote for Labor. In the United States, they vote for Democrats. And so approaching half the votes now, the Democratic Party, come from non-whites. When I was growing up, political parties were based on social class. People from the working class, they voted Democrat. People in the sort of business class or professional class, they voted Republican. Now, the working class, if you're white, you start to vote Republican. And huge numbers of Donald Trump supporters were working class whites. They would have, their fathers would have voted Democrat. And this is really happening throughout the West. It's becoming racialized. Everything's race now. It used to be more social class and a lot more sort of basic agreement on ideas and institutions and everything. Now it's more polarized. It's what you expect. The multiculturalism is going to produce more conflict. And, certainly the liberals have thrived on promoting identities, ethnic and religious identities of these immigrant groups, as we've talked about already. And this then eventually leads to polarization. And so you have just vicious, vicious politics in America. Nobody's ever seen anything like this. The hatred for Trump on the left is just astounding. I mean, I don't support a lot of things Trump has done, but the hatred coming from these people is just amazing. It really pervades. It's not just Trump, but they also hate anybody who would vote for him, who would say anything positive about anything he's ever done, anything positive about any member of his family. It's like that, you know, it's like crazy, crazy stuff.
Yeah. Apparently even wearing a MAGA hat will get you assaulted in most parts of America.
Definitely. Yeah. I was watching Tucker Carlson last night, he's a national TV host on Fox News, and he showed a video of some old guy, he's like 85 years old, and he had a sign protesting abortion, which is a big political issue in our country. And some guy in San Francisco just kicked the crap out of him. He's 85 years old. This young guy, he's probably 25, 30 years old. He's on the ground. He's kicking him. They had to take the guy to the hospital. And, of course, the guy runs off, the police supposedly will try to identify him. But San Francisco is so far left that I can hardly believe that he will be prosecuted. Sort of like the case of Jussie Smollett. I don't know if you've heard of him down there in Australia.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
Yeah. Have you had anything like that? I mean, it's not just he did this, but then the prosecutor in Chicago just drops the charges, no matter how
just
much
evidence. It. Yeah, yeah. It really is. It's the breakdown of the rule of law, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's really, we're entering a different age where there are different categories of offender and they get treated differently.
Yeah.
I think it's been called the third worldization of America, the American judicial system.
Because that's what it's going to be. And white people can look forward to a future where if they get caught up in the criminal justice system, they are not going to get an even break. They're going to have juries that are opposed to them. We're going to have prosecutors that are opposed to them. I mean, this entire Mueller investigation, probably the most important thing about it is yet to come out about how they conducted their investigations. The strong arm tactics that I just would have thought would be abhorrent in a democracy. I mean, it was really like the Soviet Union where they would give people, these confessions that they'd ask them to sign, even though they didn't do anything. And they would say, well, if you don't sign this, 25 years in prison. Is this the America I grew up in? No. But that's what's happening throughout the West. We're getting more and more of that police state mentality. And it's, I fear it's going to end up enforcing political correctness with that kind of just draconian, vicious, violent tactics that just don't have no concern for the rule of law. The whole tradition of English, British jurisprudence and the whole thing of our heritage is down the drain.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think the whole Mueller probe was basically designed to derail Trump's agenda for the first couple of years, which it's been successful in derailing the immigration agenda, ending birthright citizenship. It's timing. I don't know. Possibly it's just a coincidence, but it seems that after Trump has publicly abandoned all of the key tenets of what he ran on in 2016, the Mueller probe ends. So he had this sort of Damocles hanging over his head. And then as soon as he basically conceded to the neocons and the liberal establishment, okay, I won't touch, the key things that you don't want me to touch, then it just ends. It's like it's a quid pro quo for abandoning the MAGA agenda.
Yeah, well, I'd never thought of that, but it's remarkable how he has not followed through on the immigration policy. He hasn't even tried. He's talked about ending birthright citizenship, which is an incredibly scandalous thing. I don't know if they have that in Australia, but in America.
They don't have it here.
They don't? Or they do?
No.
They don't.
No, they don't.
You get this tourist coming in from China or anywhere, or over the most commonly over the southern border. They walk in, they're pregnant, They go to the local emergency room, have a baby, and suddenly the child's a citizen, and they can then go on welfare because the welfare programs are geared to supporting children. And so if you are the mother of a child, even if you're not a citizen, you will go on welfare. And something like 63% of all of these illegal aliens are on welfare benefits. And of course they're going to want to come. Huge magnet to come to America. For one reason or another, they can get on public assistance. And it's just nuts. But don't get me started.
it really is.
It's just sometimes you want to throw up your hands at what is going on in this country. But birthright citizenship is one. He also promised in his immigration program to lower the number of legal immigration, because we have well over 1 million legal immigrants every year. Just imagine 1 million immigrants every year. I mean, per capita, you may have the same, but somehow over 1 million is amazing. Yeah. And, that's like a very large city every year coming in. And they're poor and they're uneducated by and large. And he wanted to have a merit system based on, educational credentials and things like that to make immigration fit with job needs to actually lower, how many people are coming. So that has not happened at all. And of course, his wall, his signature program, is not really going to stop anything, even when it goes in there. I mean, it's a good thing. It'll maybe lessen it some. It'll make it harder, perhaps. But they have these laws where as soon as you step in the country, then you get a hearing. And so they're just flooding the country now. And so many people, they can't process them. You're just letting them go. And of course, these people will never show up for a citizenship hearing. Australia's been pretty tough on these illegal immigrants, haven't they? They got this
island. So maybe I'll talk a bit about Australia's immigration program. So Australia has a very high immigration program. So population of 25 million. So in recent years, migration program has averaged 200,000 per year. That doesn't include international students. So, we have, I think it's close to 500,000 international students staying here. A lot of them later on qualify for visas, for work visas and other educational visas. So they don't end up going back to their country of origin. They stay on. So the actual numbers, the official numbers hide a lot of what is actually happening. Australia, in contrast to America, Australia's immigration program is heavily tilted towards China and India. So, Chinese tend to be, unlike the Mexicans, they tend to be welfare dependent. They tend to actually, compete with white students to get into universities. They compete for the professional jobs. They actually, on average, earn more than white Australians. And then in recent years, we've had lots and lots of Indians come in who take the lower tier jobs as well. Growing up in Australia, I virtually never saw an Indian until about 15 years ago. Now, wherever I go, there's Indians pretty much everywhere. So it's a different makeup of the program. Of course, we have the refugee program as well, and that's where you're getting your Africans, the Sudanese, and other migrants from the Middle East. Australia's immigration program is heavily tilted towards Asians, towards the Chinese, and they tend to be wealthier. They tend to become professionals. They're not welfare dependent. So from an economic point of view, it's easy for the government to argue that they actually help the economy. Of course, they drive up property prices and make buying a home out of reach for many young Australians because real estate is so expensive. Right. Which I believe is something that's happened in Canada as well, especially in Vancouver. I've heard that the Chinese bought up all of the real estate. So we're a slightly different situation, but either way you look at it, whether you're looking with America, America being flooded with third world immigrants, or Australia with Asian migrants or Indian migrants, it's still not good for white Australians. It is not in the interests of white Australians to lose your demographic majority eventually, exactly. which will happen if we continue down the path we're going down, to lose cultural power, to lose political power. And with that goes, you know, confident cultural confidence and self-assertion. So it's all negative, whether we're looking at Australia's immigration program or the US immigration program.
Yeah, and I think Australia's in danger of having the top rungs of the society taken over by Chinese and Jews and things like that, that where the native elites will be displaced. But anyway, you can maybe talk about that in a minute, but we're at the point with Dr. Bauer here, and we are now into questions.
Yeah.
But before we do that, I just want to do another little brief pitch for the Accidental Observer. I mean, the Accidental Quarterly. I also have the Accidental Observer, which has shorter articles typically, and less academic focus. But anyway, again, it's very important to subscribe, to support organs like the publications, like the Accidental Quarterly, that are on our side, that are taking our point of view. I mean, one of the things, I mean, in doing all my research on Jewish intellectual history and their influence in America and so on, I noticed is that Jews be able to start these small magazines that ended up becoming very influential, things like Partisan Review and other left-wing publications. The American Jewish Committee sponsored Commentary became a very influential intellectual journal. But Partisan Review published a lot of very famous intellectuals, and they coalesced eventually, many of them became neoconservatives, strongly ethnocentric, very pro-Israel, but also very cosmopolitan when it comes to immigration policy in the West. So they promoted these ideas at the sort of top levels of our society. They supported them with subscriptions. Those publications stayed in operation for decades. Commentary, at least, and I'm not sure about Partisan Review, but Commentary, at least, is still going strong and still influential. So it's something we have to do on our side. I mean, our big lack in life is having media on our side. And as we've emphasized in this program, the academic-oriented media is important. Again, it's not all ivory tower stuff. We, you know, the academic community leads, and having well-written, well-researched articles, have it out there, have it archived. This is a very important asset for our side. So it's important to think about where to put it, a little bit of money. It's only $60 a year for a membership. If you live in America, it's $100 if you live overseas, because we have to mail it. But if you just want the online version, it's only $30, I believe. So now you can just access on your computer from anywhere in the world. So that is the pitch. Please think about it. All right, some questions here. Okay. The first question here, I guess for me, why has the Catholic Church, particularly under the present Pope, given up or are afraid of calling out Jews? Well, I think that the maybe Brenton could comment on this. I think this goes back to the last, since the early 1960s, with the
Vatican II.
Vatican II, yes. Where they completely changed the liturgy of the Catholic Church. When I was growing up, you did have the Holy Week services would talk about the perfidious Jews and really blame Jews for the crucifixion. That all went away at that time, and it was really the result of Jewish pressure and influence. And again, the influence of Jews around the world just dramatically increased after World War II, everywhere in the West. The Catholic Church was no exception. And there were individual converts who were Jewish, but they converted to Catholicism, and then they really ended up pursuing Jewish interests within the Catholic Church. We have a few articles on that, on Accidental Observer. So it's a very interesting story, but The Catholic Church has been compromised. And sadly, really, that's true of all the churches in the West that I'm familiar with, especially the mainline Protestant churches, Episcopalians, Methodists, and so on. And then you have Christian Zionists who are gung-ho pro-Israel. They are these people are really very religious, but they're very pro-Jewish. But again, they don't have much influence. But if you're talking about religion in America, it has been compromised. Okay, let's have a couple more here. How about one? Would you have anything to add on that, Brent?
No, I would just say that the current Pope, from the way I see it, I think he's a genuine leftist. Yeah. And basically accepts the contemporary, leftist worldview. So why is he so, pro-Jewish? Because basically he's accepting their frame of the way the world works.
Yeah. Here's another one. You might want to answer. It says, will white people ever get a racial consciousness and start promoting their interests? Or are we destined to become extinct?
I don't think we're destined to become extinct. So there's still hundreds of millions of white people in the world. Yeah. And I think as our numbers, relatively speaking, decline, I think it's inevitable that white identity and consciousness will grow. And it has really, if we look at the rise of the alt-right since, 2015, 2016, right. I think that's symptomatic of a rising consciousness that is a product of demographic change. People are feeling... Yes. White people are feeling under siege. Their neighborhoods are changing very rapidly. And I think it's only going to get intensify in the future. And that's in America. That's in Europe. That's in Australia. I think that is inevitable. It's evolutionarily adaptive behavior, and it is inevitable, and it will continue.
I think you're right. I hope you're right, but we do see a lot of signs of this. I mean, you talked about America with the rise of Trump, really. A lot of studies concluded that a lot of Trump voters, not all of them certainly, but a lot of Trump voters were motivated by feeling that things had changed so fast, that immigration, that they weren't comfortable in their own hometowns anymore, that sort of thing. And if you look at Europe, you've got Matteo Salvini now in Italy, preventing the migrant boats from docking. Yeah, and in America, you've got the Republican Party, which is the white people's party. It's often said that. It's called that now. 90-some percent of Republican votes come from white people. And it keeps increasing, like 1.5% every 4 years. So this is happening. And there are a lot of things to be encouraged about. Simply the election of Trump, which is practically a miracle, in my opinion. And of course, he hasn't fulfilled their expectations, but that's not entirely his fault by any means. But it's symptomatic, and there may be somebody else come along without some of Trump's baggage and problems who would do a better job. I think there will be people like that, figures that will arise. And again, Europe, we see the rise of nationalist parties in a number of countries, and Eastern Europe is really making a wall against this sort of thing. I mean, none of those countries, Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, Austria now is a government that's, getting on more on our side than pretty much any other Western European government, except Italy. So there's some good things happening here. We're not there yet, obviously. We're not going to be. In any case, we have to fight. We have to assume that extinction is not inevitable. Another thing, what can rank and file white Americans do to assert and protect their interests within PC culture? Well, one thing is to subscribe to Oxford Quarterly, as I've said. There are other things we can do, certainly. Do you have some ideas on that, Brenton? Or...
So obviously, yeah, exactly. Support, the Occidental Quarterly. I know you can donate to the Occidental Observer as well.
Yeah.
Is that correct? Yep. And other groups that assert white identity, so American Renaissance, and other groups, support them, give them a donation. obviously read our content and spread the word in your social circle and family circle. Spread the word about what we stand for. It's nothing terrible. It's very normal. It's a group of people standing up for its interests. And do what you can within your limited social and family circle to spread the word. And yeah, if you have money, support white causes. And obviously, if there's a candidate in your country who supports white interests, even if they're only, you know, they may not be an ethnic nationalist, they may be a civic nationalist, obviously vote for the best option that you have. And yeah, do what you can within what you have, basically, is right. My position.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, civic nationalists are not all bad. I mean, I remember someone on Twitter today was saying, oh, these nationalists in Poland, they're just civic nationalists, they're weak need and so on. Well, they've been very effective. They do not have immigration there. And I think that's the main thing. And if you talk to Salvini, I don't think that he would espouse some kind of racialism. He wouldn't quote, population genetic, literature on race or make explicit statements. But, he's doing the job. And that's what you have to do. And Trump as well. I mean, in this country, he never came out, four square in some kind of, with racial program. But he was saying things that we had never heard from mainstream politicians say for a very long time. And so you can do a lot of things without necessarily becoming explicitly racist. But essentially, we all have to do what we can do. Some people write articles like Brenton writes terrific articles. And I write things, I edit things, I go to conferences and speak. But other people can have a little money, extra money. You can donate it. You can join these organizations, as Brandon was saying. American Renaissance is a good one. And that's the kind of thing that we can do to really, support the people that are on our side and the organizations that are on our side. Someone asked me, when did you notice the anti-white brainwashing being so ramped up? You said growing up, you did not see it. What could they feel this was ramped up? I suppose we could ask Brenton that first. When did you really notice anti-white propaganda? I think you have noticed that in the Australian media, that things have changed since, past decades.
Yeah, I would definitely say the last decade, it's really ramped up in intensity. But I would, looking back, I would say probably the 90s was the watershed decade where this cultural Marxism was really entrenched in the universities. I know some would even say the 80s, but I think, the 90s is when basically the academia was completely taken over by the left and the media kind of followed. Yeah. Soon after.
Yeah, I recount experiences at academic parties in the 1980s. I was a professor, and you go to these parties, and there was just an assumption that you thought Reagan was a blithering idiot and a sort of latent Nazi. And if you didn't believe that, you were, so I basically shut up and people would make jokes about Reagan and so on. I would just sort of, just go along with it because that's what you sort of had to do. So it was there in the 80s when I was growing up. Of course, you didn't see anything. We were proud. I remember growing up, I remember looking at a globe and looking at the British Empire saying, wow, that's amazing. And just American culture, when I grew up, there was so much pride sort of in the, still you see a lot of Western movies. And they would sort of, take the side of the settlers, the pioneers, oftentimes against the Indians. And we were sort of the heroes, of our own story. And that's the way it is with people. People create a culture. And they have a starring role for themselves. And that's just absolutely normal. You look at every tribal group has a story like that. Well, we did, but we don't anymore. Now it's how evil white people were and always have been. And the only thing about our past is taking land from the Indians and Jim Crow and slavery. And then all the little bits of racism you see now, they'll amplify that. So white people are evil. And we see more and more of that. I mean, it's so mainstream now, especially in publications like Huffington Post, Slate. You see it all the time. But even in the New York Times, they hire people who have a history of making anti-white tweets. So I noticed in the 1980s, but... Yeah, it has ramped up. The real explicitly anti-white stuff really in the last decade, I'd say, just fairly recently, where you see, just today, the New York Times published a thing by some black guy saying why he doesn't date white women anymore. And it was just like, he's sort of reformed and he likes his own people now. I mean, I think it's fine that he doesn't date white women and all that. I think it was terrible for white women to do this, but the same time, this is the New York Times, really saying, white people aren't a good match for sensible minorities. Anyway, somebody asked me if I'd consider running for president. Yeah, fat chance. No way. I do not go on quixotic adventures like that. Someone says, would it be a good idea to produce more rightist art than just memes? Actually, you probably have some things to say about that, Brendan, because you've written a lot about art and culture. The art world has been a casualty of the left in the 20th century. Isn't that right?
It absolutely has. So the two art movements that I've kind of really explored in depth are Dada, which was around from the 19-teens. It actually didn't last very long, but very, very influential. It was the first wave of what we call conceptual art, the idea that art is an idea, it's not a product. And, of course, that these days, that's very prominent. We have conceptual art where, you have an unmade, Tracy Emin, famously, her unmade bed is a work of art. And Jews were very, very prominent in the Dada movement. So it was actually started by a guy called Tristan Zara, who was a Romanian Jew. And he, his real name was Samuel Rosenstock. So he took on this name of Tristan Zara. It actually means I'm sad in my country, in Romanian. And the reason why he was sad, why was he sad? Well, because of anti-Semitism in Romania. So his movement, it was a response to World War One as well. The fact that, all the destruction caused by World War One, that his idea was that the Enlightenment had failed, reason had failed. But it wasn't just World War One. It was also, incidents of anti-Semitism in Eastern Europe. He inaugurated this movement called Dada, became very influential in Germany and France, actually moved to America. So there was in New York in particular, and it had long-term effects on art, on American art and on world art. I've also written about, the abstract expressionists, which I regard as a sort of a Jewish cultural, movement, artistic movement. I wrote a series of articles about Mark Rothko, extremely overrated artist. So if anyone's familiar with the work of Mark Rothko, it's basically his mature works are basically a rectangle, a colored rectangle with two or three other colored rectangles on them.
What a genius.
And those works, those works now sell for tens of millions of dollars. I think recently one sold for upwards of $80 million. And his career, he was very much pushed by the Jewish art establishment in New York. Peggy Guggenheim was a prominent patron of his. His art managers that he had were Jews who were tied into the New York art market and basically made his name. In general, abstract expressionism, it's actually interesting because the 1950s was sort of right before the full Jewish takeover of American culture in the 1960s. Yeah. And it was very much a movement of alienation. So there was alienation at the WASP culture that still, it was in its death throes, but still dominating American culture. So it was a response to that. It was also a response to, because all of these artists were radical leftists, they were hoping that with World War II that America would become socialist, would adopt socialism. So it was, there was that element as well, that, you know, alienation that socialism hadn't taken hold, but yeah, alienation against the traditional WASP culture that they were kind of rebelling against. And also against, it was very much a response to the regionalists. So the group of artists who were very much interested in portraying rural America.
Right.
And of course, a lot of these abstract expressionists were, you know, obviously city dwellers prominently in New York. So you had artists like Grant Wood, Thomas Hart Benton, John Stuart Curry, the regionalists who would portray rural America and rural American values, you know, hard work and so on. And it was very much a rejection at its heart. It was a rejection of that kind of that, notion of American identity. It was very much a movement against that, heavily promoted by Jewish critics, Jewish art critics in New York. So prominently among them was Clement Greenberg, who was a writer for Partisan Review, the publication you mentioned before. I go into detail about Clement Greenberg and Mark Rothko and kind of that whole scene. But yeah, those two movements are really, so Dada, abstract expressionism, and then later on as we move into the 60s and 70s with pop art, conceptual art, it really has taken Western art down a path that is not, you know, conducive to promoting a positive white identity or a positive even American or Western identity.
Right, or a sense of beauty even. The whole idea of beauty.
Right, that too, yeah, especially, yeah.
There's no sense of that anymore. You do something that sort of hasn't been done and offends the bourgeoisie and you've got it made. If you get the right critics behind it.
The notion of the artist as under a duty to be transgressive, right. that very much goes back to Dada, to the Dada movement, that, you know, the culture, basically they said that Western civilization is rotten and needs to be rebuilt from ground zero, which is very much, you know, a Jewish mentality in the diaspora going back a long time. They made that manifest in that movement. And yeah, basically anti-nationalist, anti-Christian, anti-religion. And we're living today, the art world today is very much a product of those movements.
Yeah. You know, when I look back in the 1950s, I see sort of golden age. I grew up in the 1950s. But it was really...
There was a lot happening then.
What? Yeah.
There was a lot happening in the 50s.
There was a lot happening.
Led to where we are today.
Beneath the surface, this was the big decade of struggle between this emerging Jewish elite and the older culture trying to maintain itself. One of the big battle points was Joe McCarthy and the McCarthy hearings focused on communists, so many of whom were Jews. I mean, large percentages of the people arrested for spying were Jews, like Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. But, you know, just large, large numbers of them. Large numbers of the people brought before those committees in the 1950s were Jews. And Jewish organizations backed them to the hilt. And no one talked about the Jewishness because that was off limits. McCarthy avoided it. He appointed a Jew to be his main man, you know, Roy Cohn. Who was gay, and then, you know, he ended up with that scandal with his boyfriend, Shine or something, whatever the name is. You know, there was just a seething culture struggle, Kulturkampf, as they say in German. Or, you know, it was going on at a time when most Americans were sort of happy, you know, they were going to ball games and interstate highway system was developing, and peace and prosperity, and Eisenhower was president, and what could possibly go wrong? Well, you know, the end was near, and people didn't see it. And of course, it came in the 1960s. So it was the 1960s countercultural revolution, which was a topic of chapter 3 in my book, Culture of Critique. There's a bunch of other things here. Probably won't have time for all of them, but one of them, when did the term supremacist get used for whites and never gets used to other groups? Nobody says you're a Korean supremacist for wanting Korea to stay majority Korean. This is so true. I mean, I don't know when this started, but it certainly is a term of art that was invented by the Southern Poverty Law Center or the ADL or one of these activist groups. They're very good with words. I mean, white privilege is another great example, you know, where if you go to a place like China or Korea, in a sense, Koreans and Chinese have, you know, Korean privilege in Korea. They have Chinese privilege in China because they are the majority. And, you know, they don't have to, you know, worry about being, you know, looked down on or anything like that for being Chinese or Korean. But for whites, you know, this is just a term, and it's really intended to make whites feel bad about wanting to retain demographic and cultural hegemony. So you got to hand it to them. It's a very good term, but it makes no sense if you think about it even for a second. The idea of white supremacists, and you see that all the time, at least in America. I don't know about Australia.
Yeah, no, it really is the Jewish epithet of choice, white supremacist. It's just everywhere. It's a complete red herring because do we believe whites are supreme or not? Well, really, it's beside the point.
Exactly.
You know, like, look, if whites were the lowest IQ group in the world, I would still support them. I would still advocate for their interests because they're my people. Yeah. Whether where they rank, whether they're supreme, whether they're what, you know, that's irrelevant. It's a complete red herring.
Yeah, you would never hear Jews talk about Jewish supremacism in Israel. And yet, of course, that is the name of the game there. They are avowedly a Jewish state. They keep out non-Jews. They deport Africans. They build separate roads for Jews and Palestinians. They have a wall with Gaza. They have this massive blockade where the Gazans are basically living on UN handouts from hand to mouth. It's just a, you know, incredible system that goes uncommented on in the major media very much. It's getting commented on more now because the left, the progressives are really hitting on it, but it's been going on way too long. I remember I'm a fairly literate guy. I read newspapers and stuff, watch TV. It wasn't until in the 70s somewhere that I really realized the fundamental reality of the Middle East, that Israel had, you know, that the Jews had taken this area, declared their state, had some wars. Then, you know, the 1967 war, which really was a war of conquest, intentionally so, as it turns out. There's an article in Mondo Weiss today, I tweeted it, making that case that Israel knew darn well that this was not a defensive war. It was a war of aggression. Anyway, the point is, I didn't know any of that stuff. The media had completely blocked it out. You had the idea that Israel was this plucky little people in the Middle East, and that's the end of the story. Anyway, it's about time. It's been a great session, I thought, with Brent. And then maybe we can have you on again. There are a lot of other things. Like you did articles on by a Jewish academic activist because of Wagner's beliefs about Jews, that sort of thing. There's just a lot more. You have a very rich body of work on Occidental Observer, I mean, and Occidental Quarterly. So again, I want to remind people, it's very important. The take-home message of all this is the importance of subscribing to Occidental Quarterly, to keeping it going, because we're standing up for our people in a way that really no other publication of the academic kind of quality is trying to do. So we are unique, a unique voice at a time when we're seeing increasingly suppression of our voice whether it's on Twitter or on Amazon selling books, on financial institutions refusing to process payments, people being outed and forced out of their jobs. I mean, one bright spot is Glenn Allen's lawsuit against the Southern Poverty Law Center. He lost his job because of what they did. They're fighting back. The Southern Poverty Law Center has lost a lot of its credibility. So these things have to be destroyed, but we have to build up our own media, our own institution. So take that to heart. Thank you very much. And we'll be on again in May. And I believe our guest is lined up to be Andrew Joyce, someone that I'm sure most all of you have heard of, presently banned from Twitter. But he is another brilliant contributor to the Axiom Quarterly. Thanks a lot, Brenton. And maybe we can do it again. I mean, again,
you
have a lot of stuff that we talk about. So let's do that again later in the year. And I really enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.